You are listening to Up to Me Radio, the best in inspirational talk radio. It's up to me.
Good evening, and welcome to this week's broadcast of Life's Tough, You Can Be Tougher. We had our premiere broadcast several weeks ago, and since then, we've been off and running. I'm Dustin Planholt, your host. This is a show about life and purpose. It's about the stories we all have. Everyone, when you think about it, has a story. Some stories may sound more riveting than others. That's to be expected. Not every story, after all, is the basis for a blockbuster movie. Yet when you think about your own story, the most important thing to consider is what you will do with it. Or, to put it another way, what will your legacy be? We're looking forward to another terrific show this evening with my co-host, Oren Stewart, and this week's special in-studio guest, baseball legend B.J. Surhoff. We're broadcasting, of course, from the Alston Carlisle Studio in Baltimore, Maryland. Before we talk to our guests, I want to welcome a sponsor who joined us last week, the POI Institute. POI is a private, holistic detox center located in gorgeous Cabo San Lucas on the Baja California Peninsula. Get a safe, effective start on reclaiming your life at POI. Call the POI Institute at 833-POI-CABO. That's 833-POI-CABO. And tell them Life's Tough sent you. Okay, let's first welcome, returning here to our studio, Oren Stewart, host of The O Factor. Hello, Oren.
Hey, Dustin. How are you, sir?
Good. Welcome back to the show, Oren.
Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Now let's introduce baseball legend B.J. Surhoff. You may know of B.J. as a former Major League Baseball player. He had a career in the big leagues that spanned more than 19 years. He started with the Milwaukee Brewers, the team that selected him as the first overall pick in the 1985 baseball draft. He played with the Brewers from 1987 through 1995. In 1996, the Baltimore Orioles signed him as a free agent. He became one of the most popular Oriole players, and he had some of his most productive years in Baltimore. At the end of the 2000 season, to the surprise of many, he was traded to the Atlanta Braves. He ended up back with the Orioles in 2003, and after the 2005 season in Baltimore, he retired from baseball. A few years later, in 2007, B.J. was inducted into the Baltimore Orioles Hall of Fame. You may also know B.J. for the nonprofit enterprise that he and his wife, Polly Wendy Surhoff, established back in the year 2000. By the way, Polly is a member of the Maryland State Athletic Hall of Fame 2017. Pathfinders for Autism works to support and improve the lives of individuals affected by autism. As the state's largest autism organization, Pathfinders helps individuals, parents, and professionals access the resources, support, and training they need. Pathfinders also works to raise public awareness of autism spectrum disorders. Hello, B.J. Great to talk to you, and welcome to Life's Tough.
Thanks, Dustin. Thanks for having me tonight.
Before we go on, I'd like to again welcome the POI Institute as a Life's Tough sponsor. The POI Institute is a private, luxurious, holistic detox center located in gorgeous Cabo San Lucas on Mexico's Baja California Peninsula. POI offers safe, medically focused Ibogaine detox treatments for individuals suffering from a variety of addictions. Call the POI Institute at 833-POI-CABO. That's 833-POI-CABO. Or check out their website, poiibogaine.com. Be sure to tell them that Life's Tough sent you. B.J., welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today, B.J. I know we got a chance to talk off air a little bit, so we didn't flush too much out, man. But just tell us about your career and how much baseball really has meant to you since having retired, actually.
Well, now the sarcastic part of me is I never retired. Ah. They just took my job.
Gotcha, so man.
I'm unemployed for the last 15 years.
Oh, man.
So it was always something I wanted to do. Grew up around the fields. My dad was an athlete. He played for the Knicks in the early 50s, but really more known throughout the country, but mostly in the Eastern Seaboard, fast pitch softball.
Wow.
So we were every weekend at the fields. You know, I had two brothers, two sisters, and it was a time where you went into the street and you played, and whoever showed up, you did whatever you did on that day. You know, stick ball, wiffle ball, bounce ball, speed ball, whatever you want to, kick ball.
You kept busy.
Whatever.
Yeah. You didn't have an iPad.
No, we did not.
No iPads. No cell phones.
I was just telling my kids
hockey,
today, man.
Whatever it was.
Yeah, I was just telling my kids today. I said, you know, back in the day, we went outside. Mm-hmm. There was no sitting in the house. So, yeah, I'm sorry. Just keep going. Yeah.
Yeah, I grew up in a small town, so it really wasn't a whole lot of issues to deal with. You know, no one rode their bike or walked around the town, and we played.
Wow.
And, you know, went outside and played. If you were inside, your parents told you get outside and go out.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Again, you know, baseball was always something I wanted to do. I was, every season, I wanted to be a football player, and then I wanted to be a basketball player, and I wanted to be a baseball player. And that went on for about 15 years in every cycle.
And baseball just grabbed a hold of you?
Well, I knew I was pretty good at it. You know, I was good at the other ones, but I was better at baseball, and it became more and more evident I was going to have more of a chance to do that. And come around my senior year, you know, I entertained a couple football things in small schools, smaller schools, some of the Ivies and whatnot, and the Yankee Conference. And then basketball came around, and, you know, that popped in my head for a little while. And, you know, and then it was really evident at the time that I was, because I had a lot of scouts coming to my games and talking to me before, and that I was going to have a chance to play in college and possibly professionally.
Wow.
Yeah. So, BJ, one of the things that I was thinking about earlier when we were talking was, how did you hyper-focus? Like, once you found, I'm good at baseball, I'm good at this thing, how did you allow yourself to take the distractions and push them to the side?
That wasn't really a problem, because for me it was all about competing. Just the absolute...
It's a good old competition.
So would you say that was your fuel?
The loathe of losing was just something. I probably wasn't known as the best sport as a kid. Because all you want to do is win. You know, that was pretty, and it didn't matter. It wasn't, you know, about trying to get here or there, college or pro. It was, we got a game today. We got to try and win.
Yeah.
You know, how do we win? How can I beat you?
So your wife's also an athlete. What's that like?
It wasn't as bad because, you know, we did different things.
Okay. Competition when it came to?
Not when it comes to swimming.
I know, right?
No, I can beat her in a 50. That's about it. But after that, and I know she's laughing right now because she knows it's true.
She's like,
but all my kids swim too, and I'm the worst swimmer in the family.
I can barely doggy paddle, so maybe
I'm the worst one in the family by
far.
Yeah. So, you know, that particular, my kids were active. We're all active. But, you know, I had brothers, I had sisters. You know, again, my dad, we were just around sports growing up. So it was what I wanted to do, and it's been a huge part of my life. It will continue to be.
Yeah.
How do you find the balance?
Well, I guess that's something you learn. I had to find the balance. Early in my career, my first year went really well, and the second and third years were not good. It was the first time I really, really had to deal with failure. And I got married at the end of my third year. And really, it may sound weird, but once I had kids, it got better for me.
Really?
At least not when it wasn't going well, when I'm home. It was
something to look forward to.
There's a diaper to be changed. I didn't really care if I got hit or not.
Did your wife say, look, because you're an athlete, you get off from diaper duty? Or
No. Because of the way the schedules were, you know, I was more up late, and I would – we did it together.
That's awesome.
As much as we could. You did the feedings and you know, again, she was doing the morning ones because I wasn't much of a morning person, and I was doing the late ones. And never forget one of the first ones. I was waiting for my son, and he was normally around midnight, and then I would wake up and I'd go. And then I waited and waited, and I went through the whole Godfather waiting for him until the last 5 minutes, and then he decided to wake up.
Oh, man.
So I missed the ending.
Yeah.
I always wanted to be involved in the kids and helping out and doing my part and being a good parent and good father.
Well, I find it quite remarkable that after 19 years in baseball, I'm blessed to have you as a friend. Being over your home and seeing your family, that you still remained together. You stayed strong. You stayed strong through, I would say, probably every challenge that I could ever have 1,000 times over.
Yeah, I mean, we all have challenges. You know, we have our disagreements. You know, the kids, there's four of them, they disagree. You know, me and my wife disagree. Yeah. The girls disagree. Me and my son disagree. We disagree. And, you know, we have issues, you know, with Mason, our son, isn't doing well. It kind of stresses everybody out. But I'm really proud of my kids and the people they become and who they are and what they've – because they grew up a little different than me but we've tried to keep things, I like the term to keep it as real as possible for them and have them be their own people, but try and give them the right directions.
That's awesome, man. That's important. It's so important, especially I can imagine as a professional athlete, you know, having to balance, like Dustin was saying, I'm sorry, Dustin, the balancing the two, you know, that's not something all of us can understand, you know, being on this side
of
the coin.
It was probably harder on them than me.
That was going to be my question to you. What would you say were some of the things that when you would come home and the kids were really like, Dad, but having to debrief from
a game. there was only one. When I say hard on them, there was one instance when my son was 11 or something. He was playing a baseball game, and my wife told me, you wouldn't believe the things they were saying to him on the field today.
Oh, man.
I'm like, yeah, you're not as good as your dad. I'm thinking, really, dude? I mean, what parent goes out to rag on an 11-year-old kid and tell him, you know, I'm glad it wasn't there?
Yeah.
You know, you think, well, hey, man, really? You know, I saw you play. You weren't very good either. I mean, come on, dude. You got a bunch of 11, 12-year-old kids out here. Why don't you just let them be kids and play? So, you know, I didn't have a lot of tolerance for that type of stuff. Let the kids be the kids and not worry about who your parents are.
So important.
So now, BJ, for the fathers out there that have to travel and the mothers that have to travel, you spent a lot of days away from the family.
Mm-hmm.
How did you keep the connection?
Well, pre-internet.
Pre-internet.
For those, as we're going over the internet. Yeah. No, it was phone calls. You know, call home, trying at the right time. When they're getting ready, when they're up, when I'm not playing, it's trying to figure out in the middle of the day. Obviously, today, in a way, it's easier to keep up because text, Skype, iMessage, or whoever, whatever avenue there is, it's easier to keep in contact, I think. In fact, it definitely is, but it gets hard. You know, the one staying at home, they bear the burden. Mm-hmm. You know, we were fortunate we had a little bit of help. We found, like anybody else, some babysitters to help us out. The biggest thing we figured out is we needed help from 4 to 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. that is drive time, school back, activities, bath time when the kids, because at one time we had 4 and 5 years. So, you know, they're pretty similar in ages, and, you know, they're doing, and so you need help with that aspect and getting this one in the bed and that one in here and there. And so an extra set of hands. So it was nice to find. We were able to find some real good help just at local colleges with babysitters.
Yeah. It's a lot to juggle. Mm-hmm. Dustin, you were saying that one time, I remember before talking about the juggling.
How do you find it's the juggle of life?
Yeah. Again, I learned from the guys I play with. I was very fortunate in Milwaukee. I lived down the street from Robin Yount and his wife, and they had 4 kids.
Wow.
And so it was really easy for me to watch how he dealt with his kids. And I got some, and how others handled it themselves. So I had some real good role models, some people to see how things worked out and what the problems are and how to possibly deal with them. But that was really got a good view watching how Michelle and Robin handled their kids.
Well, having seen what your kids think about you, the advice you can give for parents to develop healthy relationships as the kids get older. Give us the secret sauce, BJ Surhoff.
There's no secret sauce there.
I need to know.
You know, one thing for me, I've said this before, I didn't mind being the uncool dad. I love my kids. I had to make decisions and treat them a certain way, reprimand them, and I didn't mind if they didn't really like it. If it was, as long as it was the right thing to do, if I wasn't strict, I don't know. I believe in a certain way of doing things and tried to keep that, especially as I got older and, you know, the driving and all the other stuff going on and whatnot. I still believed in handling a certain way. And like I said, all I was concerned about was kids being safe and being okay and being good people. So I didn't mind being the uncool person.
Very powerful.
And sometimes that wasn't always.
I tell you, man, that's a lesson in itself. You know, so many parents of today want to relate.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, young dads, I've got an 8-year-old and a nearly 6-year-old.
Yeah.
And the struggle that I have is as they get older, well, as I'm getting older, they're getting older.
Yeah.
And finding that ability to communicate.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to be my kid's parent and father first, their friend second. But that doesn't mean we can't be close, but there's also the line trying to understand, too, playing dual roles. And it's not easy. I don't think it's easy for anybody, but it's something that I believe in. I was reprimanded as a kid. Probably different than you're allowed to do these days.
You're the only one, huh?
You say definitely different. Yeah. But look at where it got you. You know.
So again, very very fortunate to have a lot of good people in my life who helped me along the way.
Awesome.
That's wonderful. So Pathfinders for Autism. How did that begin?
Pathfinder started out as a group of parents, really my wife and a bunch of people she met were meeting as a support group over, and most of the people that were meeting had a connection with Dr. Becky Landover, Kenny Krieger, and Becky's
great organization.
Yeah, and Becky's wonderful. And out of it, they started to talk, how can we try and help people like us that are going to go through what have gone through, getting the diagnosis, learning how to try and handle it, and letting people know who that are coming, that there are other people out there going through what you're going through. Because it was probably one of the worst days of my life getting a diagnosis that my son wasn't, atypical, wasn't normal.
Wow. So now Pathfinders today, is it what you thought it was going to be?
Heck no. I couldn't, if you'd asked me what it was going to be, I have no idea.
Wow.
In the early stages, I wasn't really, really involved. I was still playing. Brian Munn was the president. Becky Galli was the treasurer. I think I was the vice president. I wasn't near as involved because I wasn't around as much. I was involved. And Bruce Schindler, our treasurer, has been there for day one. And Becky Galli, like I said, she's our treasurer. That group of people really got the organization off the ground. And, again, I tried to help as much as I can. And the big thing I always wrestled with was my son has a neurological disorder. Do I want to turn him into a poster child or do I want to let him?
Yeah.
On the flip side, I may have a platform to try and help others, but trying to keep that balance, too, where trying to help the cause, help him, but not all the everything
that would come with
be, and let him be him.
Yeah.
And so again, I was very selective about the stuff I did, the interviews I did or how much awareness, and when I did it, because I wanted my kids to have some sort of normalcy in their life and not just be all about autism. It's very, very important in our life, but it was a conscious effort to get in a little bit by little, but the organization was an all working board. We did all the work. We raised the money. We helped start the programs. The first thing we decided was that we had this big grandiose plan that we were hoping to have this huge facility out in the country with horses. And then we go, I don't think we have quite have $30 million.
It'll be there soon.
So the budget. Yeah.
If there's anybody looking to donate $30 million to Pathfinders
for Autism. Said, you know what? We have about, I don't know, we could raise a few thousand dollars here. Let's start an online database. So a resource center so people call in or go online and get information. Because information is the key. We're not a service provider. We don't.
Knowledge is power.
We don't do research. We try and help give people the tools to help their child.
Wonderful. Well, we'd love to work on that with you. When it's built, we'll put it on lifestuff.com.
I'm not sure that's our goal right at the moment, but it is.
Paul, if you're listening in, that's the goal.
Because actually, I had a question for you, BJ, in regards to you and your wife. What roles do you both play within the organization now?
Well, currently, and I don't know for how long, the past little while, I am president of the board.
Okay.
I wouldn't read too much into that.
Gotcha.
Someone needs to have the title. we're a very hands-on board, interactive. We have a lot of people doing a lot of different things. We have many committees. We run outings, fundraisers, and But Polly's real involved on the board, but she gets more involved on the event side.
On the event side, got you. Yeah.
Any special goals coming up the organization has between now and, say, end of fiscal year?
Or calendar year? Be over budget.
Be over budget. That's it. Be over budget.
No, like anybody else, every other nonprofit, we need to raise money. You know, that's what you do as a nonprofit.
Yeah.
In order to do what we do, we need to raise money because everything we do is free to people. No, our families pay, and they pay
that's
zero.
Remarkable.
Nothing that we do costs people money.
And what you guys are doing is generational. I mean, look at your own children, that now their kids will know about the work of autism or Pathfinders for Autism.
Yeah, the awareness is one component of what we do. But the programming that we run around the state and getting people information in order. So the goal is to reach every corner of the state, and operate and do programming in every single county of the state. Most of our work has been done in Baltimore, Howard, Hartford. That's where the most of it is done. But we have hit every single county in the state, and we want to continue to expand our reach. But like anything else, whatever we can do in terms of raising money allows us to do more. We went from no staff members to 8, and we have some self-advocates that work for us that do some of the program and come in our seminars.
Wow.
We have a young man who is autistic, and he does data entry for us, and he's phenomenal. They used to quality control. They don't even, he's just so good at it. And we have some individuals that come from some of the places that have it, that deal with people on the autism spectrum, and they come do some work in our office too. And my son also, he volunteers and he works at it one day a week. So we're doing more and more of that. But we run programming around the state. We're training just about anybody, but law enforcement, firefighters, EMS, EMT, first. We've trained dental students, medical students, and one maybe the most important, the people on the front lines are ER doctors and nurses, because those are the people that are going to get the cases that come in and deal with an individual that has an issue and try and figure out how to deal with them, someone who is on the spectrum. And that program has been phenomenal. You know, we've trained police officers what to look for.
Yeah, so let's talk that through. For those not having a family member with autism and our listeners around the world, what are the signs?
Well, they're all different, but some of it, they can be very recluse. They may not be verbal. They may not listen. So they can be seen as standoffish. And so there was an incident up in Frederick a number of years ago where an individual with a disability, unfortunately, there was a fatality.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things we're trying to avoid. We're trying to give people the tools that are going to come in contact with people, first responders, police officers, firefighters, paramedics, what to look for, what the possibilities. You know, do they have possibly a medical alert? Is there something to look for? Do they stim? Do they flap? Or they self-talk? Do they wear headphones? Do loud noises bother them? So there's some signs, and our staff has created the programming and the content, and we do the trainings with some other trainers that we help, and our program has gotten just fantastic reviews from the people we talk to.
With some of the events that you all have coming up, are there training events?
Like, yeah, we have a number. They're on our website. You can go on our website.
So go to the website, check
absolutely,
it out.
Absolutely, yeah, okay. PathfindersAutism.org.
Awesome.
And we do them. You know, a number of years ago, we met with the county executive, and we talked to him because there's a mandate for police and fire to have some sort of training.
Okay.
And we presented our program to it, and now we train the Baltimore County Sheriff and Fire.
That's awesome.
So it started with us training the state police cadets. They came to us. Mm. And so we've trained those people all around the state on how the things to look for, you know, the signs. And for example, if an individual or child goes missing, they're people on the spectrum, percentage-wise, are more apt to gravitate towards water.
Hmm. Oh,
so
okay, really?
where are the lakes and the ponds in there? And so those type tools to know what to look for and where to possibly find it. When my son was about 2 years old, my wife had all the kids in the pool, and she turned for 1 second, it was getting dust, and turned, and all of a sudden he was gone. And she couldn't find him for about 45 minutes. Well, he had walked down the driveway across the street, and was throwing rocks in the pond at our neighbor's house. Fortunately, he could have swam. Yeah. But, you know, and of course, I was out of town.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's very, very common for individuals on autism spectrum to gravitate towards water. Many of them are very comfortable in the water.
In the water, yeah.
And that's another program that we've done. We have trained people, swim instructors, how to teach kids on the spectrum how to be water safe. And that's another program we're really, really proud of.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's important. Yeah. Awareness is everything.
Yeah, learning. And if I could continue just on one spec, one of the things we do is free family fun nights. Well, for I don't know how many years running, we'll rent out the... So to go out with your kids is nice. A lot of people who have autistic kids, they don't feel like they can do it. Either their child acts up or they don't feel comfortable, or it's very, very expensive, and, you know, they're spending money on other things. They just can't do it. So one of the things we do is we rent out the aquarium on a Sunday afternoon where it's sensory friendly, and it's just for us.
Yeah.
And we have upwards of 2,000 people come.
Wow.
And a family of four can come in. It doesn't matter what their child does. And they come, they get to go to the aquarium as a family.
That was going to be one of my questions. How many families come? But you said 2,000.
It's amazing. As many as 2,000 people.
Wow.
And it doesn't matter the tantrum or how they're acting up or what they're doing. Nobody cares because we're all in the same boat.
That is so important. Yeah. They can feel, you
and
know.
And it's like a program we're very, very proud of. And we've done it at minor league ballparks, too, where you can get to go watch a ball game and sit in an area designated for them. And, you know, again, all of it's free to them.
Wow. So another question for Pathfinders. Where the organization is today, where do you see it in 10 years?
Well,
where's your heart?
That's all part of a strategic plan. I'm not the best strategic planner.
All right,
give
us a Reader's Digest.
But again, we want to continue to expand our reach. We want to continue to run the programming of training, and we want to expand it as much as we can. We operate in the state of Maryland, and that's what we do well, and we want to serve the people in our neighborhood. And one of the things we talk about, and I'm very proud of, is when we have a fundraiser and people do give us money, we're very cognizant that there's a lot of choices of where your dollars go, and we feel really, really good about how we make those dollars go a long way, and we're protective of it. And we also want them to know that you may be helping your neighbor. It's staying right here in your neighborhood. The money you give is not going to a national organization. It's not going to Alaska or California or Mexico or somewhere. It's staying right here in your community.
In state, yeah.
And that's really, really a big deal to us. And we'd like to continue to expand our reach on the Eastern Shore and to Southern Maryland and out in Western Maryland. And we really like to start doing a little bit more in the city. It's been a tough nut to crack. We think that's an area that we really could and do a lot of good.
So on the stats side, how many percentage or what is the percentage of families or individuals that are affected by autism?
So autism now is one in every 59 children.
59.
One in 59. And here in Maryland, it's one in 50.
Wow.
Wow.
And it's 4 to 4.5 times more prevalent.
And why do you think that is? What is it?
The answers to that, I think, would all be speculation. I'm sure there's some PhDs and some research people or some immunologists, virologists, or something with an ist on the end could tell you a lot better than I can. But there's a lot of theories, you know, genetic, there's environmental, they're better at diagnosing. So the actual answer, we don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. We don't know. But we do know it's at least four times more prevalent in boys than girls.
In boys than girls.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Boy. And there's thousands of kids in our public schools that are on the spectrum. There's some wonderful programs that around in the public schools that deal with the kids.
Would you say, especially within the city, when you brought that up, possibly undiagnosed as well?
Oh, sure. A lot of places. And that's where you're not possibly out in Western Maryland.
Gotcha.
Where they're not exactly going to just take to somebody from. So, you know, when we go into an area, we partner with the local community there. We don't just come in and say, hey, we're Pathfinders and we're going to do this here. So we'll partner with somebody from the Eastern Shore and run this program and down in Southern Maryland and run that program or out in Frederick or Hagerstown. And we've gotten grants to do stuff like that or go down to PG or to Montgomery. So we are always partnering with local groups and get their clientele, their groups to find out what they need to learn about and want to learn about.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's for the people that are out of state, where would be a great site to send them to learn about autism?
Oh, well, our Autism Speaks is the national organization. They've done a great job consolidating a number of charitable organizations, become part of the national voice, and especially when it comes to policy and lobbying and over. But we feel really good about what we do here. And
it's quite remarkable.
Yeah, here in the state. Again, Autism Speaks is around the country. Autism Society of America is another one. Okay. So, and we've done stuff with both of them. But we feel like here in our community that we are the group to talk to.
So for the early days, for people like me that have young kids and their child gets diagnosed with autism, talk about the early days. What advice can you give young parents?
That may be the toughest thing. Like I told you, the day we got the diagnosis for my son, I took him and the neurologist didn't have the best bedside in the world. He was very matter of fact, and that's the way he was. And when I came home that day and walked to the backyard, and Polly came and said, "What'd he say?" And I couldn't get the words out because he's autistic. And she wanted to know what it meant. I didn't know. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know what it was going to mean for his future, where it's going to be. And again, where he is from there, he's light years. We just want him to speak. I mean, our son's more on the higher functioning spectrum, a savant in some ways, but deals with issues every single day, anxiety, OCD, which is many individuals deal with also. So one thing that we are very, very proud of is if you call our organization, the people that answer the phone, there's a really good chance that someone on the end of the phone has an autistic child. The people that our staff, I believe, I got to do the math real quick. I believe four of our staff have children with kids on the spectrum.
So they'll have the compassion and the empathy.
I understand. Yeah.
And when you call and you have questions, if we don't have the answer, Trisha's going to find it. Shelly's going to find it. Neil's going to find the answer for what it is you need. And we're going to get you. We're not going to be able to solve and change the diagnosis, but our staff is going to help you find and do the best they can to get you the answers that you're looking for.
So now speak to the dads out there, BJ. The dads, kids.
That's a great question because it doesn't. I've often thought there maybe should be some support groups for dads too. And in fact, I've been invited to go speak at a dad for conference in Chapel Hill where they do a ton of research and they're really doing great things in there. And I think it for other dads to see how they deal with it, and again the guilt
that comes into play
on both sides and who, what, where, why, instead of asking those questions. Let's move on and try and figure out how can I help my child.
Yeah,
that's wonderful. We have a live caller, Dr. Steve Plannell from St. Agnes Hospital on the line. Yes, he's a family member, and he is my cardiologist. Dr. Plannell, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dustin.
All right, so you got BJ Surhoff in the room.
Can you hear?
Yes, we hear
can
you.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can. Yes. Yeah.
So, BJ, first of all, I was always an admirer of yours when you played for the Orioles. But I'm even a greater admirer now that you've taken your fame and your notoriety, and rather than turning it into something that you would use for your own benefit, you've turned it into a program, a resource, to really help others. And I think that's extremely admirable. I know you're probably blushing in the studio now. But all you have to do is read the headlines today to find out how people are using their position or their contacts to advance their own careers or to benefit themselves. But you've taken it to help others. And I admire you tremendously for that and want to commend you for that. It's just let other people know that it's how proud we are of you for doing that.
Thank you.
The other thing I'd like to say is that, autism is not always overt. There are various degrees of autism.
Right.
And I've seen people who are clearly autistic who are vilified or made fun of because they're described as socially awkward or they don't have the social graces other people could have. When in fact, it's their autism that makes them behave the way they do or say the things they do or have some unusual behaviors that people are uncomfortable with.
Yes.
And I think it's important to point that out because a lot of people who are labeled as socially awkward or no social grace, in fact, have very mild forms of autism with which they can function day to day, but it's very difficult for them in certain social situations.
Yes, very much so. There's a lot of individuals that, and that's one of the things people look for is do they withdraw, and that was one of the telltale signs for us was our son started to withdraw. And he had developed very quickly. He was on track, and you know, next thing you know, he didn't ever want to be around anybody, and he was only 18 months. So people withdraw a lot, but I think a lot of us like to withdraw sometimes.
Yes, indeed.
There are varying degrees. Many individuals have other afflictions, either MR or Downs along with it. So there are people that are savants and their IQ and what's inside their brain, and they have abilities that can just wow you. So it's very, very important for awareness and that people understand there's not something wrong with that child. That's just how he is, and he likes to flap his arms. It makes him feel good. He likes to self-stim. You know, hopefully it's not in a way that they hurt themselves, because many people with autism have self-abusive behaviors also.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we all need to be a little bit more understanding of one another and our behavior patterns and realize that, I guess as Dustin's put it, you know, everybody's got a story, and you don't know exactly what that person or this person has been through. If you've ever watched it, actually Chick-fil-A, I don't work for Chick-fil-A or own their stock.
Love Chick-fil-A.
They
I
do
love
a
it too.
Chick-fil-A
is delicious.
They can do sponsor. A training video, and in their training video, they have different people walking in and out of the store, and it's in slow motion and it's silent. And the point is, they have a little monogram there. This person was just diagnosed with cancer. This person just got divorced. Right. This person lost their home, and the point is to their employees is that, look, you don't know what somebody's story is. You know, you're in there, you think you're having a bad day, but you have no idea what their day is like, and what their underlying issues are that may magnify their problems. One of the things I tell my staff all the time is everybody who walks in the door of our office, you should treat like your mom or your dad, because you don't know what they've been through, you don't know what they're going through. And they may not have a serious problem, but they're in a doctor's office, a heart doctor's office.
Right.
They're scared to death half the time just being in there.
Yeah.
So you know, have some compassion, have some understanding, and treat them the way God intended us to treat one another, with love and respect. And, you will be okay.
Great point, Steve. Great point.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Planthold.
Thank you, man.
Okay. Nice talking to you.
Hi, too.
Nice show.
All right, thanks, Doc.
Yeah,
BJ, thanks for all your contributions to Baltimore.
Thank you.
We are very proud of BJ Surhoff in Baltimore, Maryland.
You know, again, Dusty, if I could just say, you know, people give me a lot of credit for it, and really, our organizations, our board, and as a board, we just try and give our staff who does the work, and the people that we have work for us also that contract, we just try and give them the tools. And we try and go get the money and raise awareness to allow them to help the people. So they really, that's where I see our role is. You know, I'm not out there doing it. And I really wholeheartedly believe this when I say it, is I get way too much credit for it. Just people happen to know because I played, but there are so many other people doing good things. And we're trying to help our staff help people.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
really what it comes down to.
You guys have an amazing organization.
Yeah, and I just want to say I commend the whole team of what you've shared with us today for the work that you all do, because awareness is everything. And a lot of times we don't, like Steve was saying, and I love Chick-fil-A, going back to that, we are saying Chick-fil-A is the spot, right? The service that they provide.
I'm getting hungry. I'll help you open later.
Look, I had it for lunch actually today. Yeah. That's every day though. But the service that they provide, mm-hmm. you know, teaches us all so much of how we should interact with one another. So it's clear that you all are doing that. Yeah. So I just want to say I commend Pathfinders and the work that you all will continuously do.
Yeah, I mean, my son affecting our family. I mean, my kids are all affect you, but he's had a profound effect on not my kids, my family, me. You know, teaching me I have to be a lot more patient.
Yeah,
and it's not always easy because he can really. Your kids can try you, but when a child on autism is not having a good day, it tries everybody's patience.
Yeah. I have a question for you. Actually, I have a nephew, and he has Asperger's. Mm-hmm. Now, does that also, from my understanding, doesn't that fall in the line
it
somewhere?
It did, but don't quote me on this 100%, but I believe they have now taken that off the spectrum.
Okay.
Yeah. Those are usually higher functioning individuals.
Okay.
I hope no one calls and says, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. But I'm pretty sure a couple of years ago they redefined, and they now took that. They're not considered autistic.
Considered autistic, yeah. I just remember hearing it. Now, granted, like you said, lately, but over the past 10, 20 years, mm-hmm. you know, the conversations had. But the importance of listening mm-hmm. and, you know, and being in tune with what we like to say, and I say air quotes, difference, the differences that we have. But I find them to be inspiring, actually. You know, it puts us in position to be willing to learn more about one another, you know, instead of seeing that the differences that we have are a problem, mm-hmm. you know. So
who helped you through all this, BJ? Yeah. Who was your Sherpa? Who did you lean on?
I guess ourselves, you know. Dustin, I'm not sure I know that answer. But we were very fortunate. We had all the people that worked with my son were fantastic. And they were some people that we found here. That one was first a college student, and she was working with kids, and she took him to, and she worked with him 40 hours a week.
Wow.
To places we never thought he'd be. And then the next, that was Barbara, the next woman, Allison, who had never worked with an autistic child in her life, learned how to do it, and she homeschooled him. You know, took him on outings and dove into it, and you know, she took him past that. So, and then he went to high school, and you know, my kids were very involved too. And fortunately, my kids are all real close, and they've gotten there. You know, it's a challenge on them too, but they're really good with him also.
Where does he fall in the? Because you said you have four.
He's my second one.
He's your second. Yeah. Okay, gotcha.
I have an older. I have a son who's 28. Okay. Mason 27. My daughter's 25 and 24.
Gotcha.
So, you know, it's nice. It was tough when they were little, but it's nice now because of how close they are in age.
There's a men's group that I go to, and one of the questions that was asked fairly recently was, at the end of your life, you will be known by, or you will be known as loving blank, blank, blank the most. That's something that I've been asking myself over and over. At the end of Dustin's life, when somebody writes it down, like, Dustin, he loved the most, I find that you have this career. You're a big deal in the baseball world. Yeah, and then I look at what you've done to bring awareness, that your legacy is one of, did you see it coming? I mean, could you have imagined that you've been able to find this ability to balance both of these lives? And as I'm sitting with you, to remain so humble, how'd you do it?
Well,
remember, life's tough. You can be tougher.
Yeah,
how did you do it?
As most people out there know, life is humbling every single day. I got humbled on the field, off the field, get humbled at home. I've never, ever done or thought about anything having to do with my legacy. I've never, ever thought about why would I be worrying about what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Someone's going to think about it later on. When I need to do what I need to do now. I don't know if you remember, we went to Cuba in 1999 and played the first game down there. And afterwards, I had to do a press conference. I'd been down there, and someone asked me, and I said, they asked me about making history. And my answer was, I never thought about making history. I always just read about it. So I never really thought about creating any kind of legacy. When I played, I just wanted to win. Or more importantly, I didn't want to lose.
Yeah, yeah. So it goes back to when you were young.
It's a better feeling.
Yeah. But I've never thought about a legacy. You know, I get satisfaction out of helping. You can't see people's lives a little bit. We talk about it. Hopefully, their life is a little bit better today than it was yesterday. And because the kids, all our kids, all of us, are going to have bad days when your kids have bad days, especially ones with disabilities, it really puts a lot of stress on everybody.
Yeah, having grown up myself with a father who wasn't there, and in the early days, a mother that wasn't there, I look to you and I look at everything you've done in your life. And it's remarkable that you found a way to, as I, from my own opinion, that the thing B.J. Surhoff loved the most was his family. That to you has been something that you've dedicated your life to being involved in their lives, no matter where you were.
No matter what's going on around you.
They're
mine.
Hey, you would say, yeah.
They're my wife. They're our responsibility.
Remember, to people around the world, people like Dustin, that didn't have somebody there.
I understand what you mean.
You and me both, Dustin. It is hard to understand.
So when you look at it, it's something that's so extra special.
I had vowed to myself I was going to be the best father I could be. Yeah. And I'm still trying to be. I mean, well, never hit.
So still a work in progress always, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I wanted to be the best father I could be. And they're our kids. And I wanted to be their father, and they're not somebody else raising my kids.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, when in my last couple of years playing, my kids are a little bit, they were old enough a little bit to, and that's all they knew growing up was me playing, was I asked the three of them, you know, how do you feel about me still playing? And they were all like, oh, yeah, Dad, that's what you do. You got to keep playing. Like, great. So it was, as I get older, it was important to me that they were still good with me playing.
Checked in.
Right. And then, you know, in hindsight, it was probably good that I was done in 2015 because I was then able to watch, because my son was 15 now, and my daughters were, I think, 12 and 11. I was able to watch all the things that I, and all the good things that they went through, and all the experiences going through and all the way through college. So, I don't know, I just, you know, I had a lot of people help me through life, here, there, everywhere. All of us could have taken different roads, or we did things and somehow they didn't get out, or, you know, we learned the lesson.
No one found out, huh?
Yeah, the lesson.
They never made ESPN.com, is that what you're saying?
No internet,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. We all did things as kids that weren't necessarily the right thing to do, but, you know, they weren't massive. We all make mistakes. And, again, one of the things I've kind of tried to preach to my kids is to fear failure but not be afraid to fail. And I think it's really, really important.
So true.
You know, it's a really, really important distinction is you can't be afraid to fail. Because if you go around being afraid to fail, you never try anything.
So true. Can't miss any shots. How does the saying go? You cannot miss a shot that you haven't taken.
Yeah, you know, and Michael's a big someone I look to.
Yes.
I haven't gotten to school him.
You're right.
Yeah, watching how he dealt with stuff. You know, he was probably the best person I ever saw with dealing with everybody.
Gotcha.
Because everybody wanted a piece of him. But, you know, he'll tell you, he missed 26 or 27 times the final shot, but he kept taking it.
Kept taking it, yeah.
So during an interview in 2010, a reporter asked you what you were most proud of in your baseball career. I'm not sure if you remember what you said back then.
Yeah.
You're snickering. All right, good. That I love my wife. All right. You said the fact that I played right gave everything I had and that nobody could question my effort. Then you added, I absolutely hated to strike out. I didn't want to be deficient in any part of the game. And I had a hard time looking at myself in the mirror if I didn't play 100%. Have you been able to take this attitude into the off-field endeavors? Pathfinders is growing.
Yeah, I was going to say,
I'll never fulfill what baseball gave me. You know, I play a lot of golf now, but it'll never be what that. Well, I'll never get anywhere near the level that I was in baseball. You know, I enjoy playing. It's just, it'll never. Unless I coach or manage, you know, I would.
It's
and
a
even that,
experience.
It's totally different because you don't have any control.
Yeah.
But the point I tried to make there was, you know, my dad said to me one time, and he played until the day he died. He was still playing fastway softball. Quit many times, but kept coming back. There's two things when you're playing. You can do it the right way, you can do it the wrong way.
Mm.
And I tried to always keep that in mind. And again, I had great people when I went to Milwaukee, the guys I got to emulate and learn from and watch. And they were the guys everyone knew, but some of the other guys too that people wouldn't know. I had great influences in my life, and I never ever wanted anybody to question my level of effort. If I could be happy with my own effort by looking in the mirror, then I knew I'd be okay.
Which is always important.
And it was important to me to be a good teammate. I can't say I was 100% of the time, but that was my number one goal, was to be a team, to to play the game every single day with the idea of trying to win the game and not really matter what happened to me.
Yeah.
So, BJ, final question for you. While the show is called Life's Tough, You Could Be Tougher, or the segment Life's Tough.
I'm really not that tough.
But BJ Surhoff is tougher. Who's the toughest man and woman that you've known?
As we were talking about this earlier, trying to define tough. There's tough exteriors and people are. So my dad was a tough guy, but on the inside, he was a marshmallow. You know, the first time I ever saw my dad cry, it killed me. When his dad passed away, but probably he just came up with the Cal on the field mentally as tough as anybody. To be able to do what he did, guys in the Hall of Fame can't even talk about playing that many games in a row.
Yeah.
And having that and bringing that to the table every single day, a professionalism that, I had to learn it too. And you're tired. Yeah. Okay. A lot of people are tired, but mentally I can be there, do my job. And, Michael, like Jordan, when I say Michael's one word person.
I was going to say, you got to tell everybody who we're talking
MJ
about.
MJ I got to say MJ.
So he's Michael to you though, right? Yeah.
Well, Michael to me is as tough as anybody. Wow. Mentally too. And again, on the court, I can't really speak to everybody in their homes and off the field, but in my arena, and Tiger's pretty damn mentally tough too.
Pretty tough.
Jack Nicklaus. I use one word people. When you're a one word person, chances are
big difference.
There's a lot of times
you've been in the company.
You've
right?
made it.
Yes. We would agree. Question for you. With the different people that you've named, right, just now, and to the question that Dustin asked as far as toughness, those lessons you hold near and dear, and I'll assume still apply with Pathfinders to this day, right?
Yeah.
And
we've gone through some lean times, and but we've hired good people. Our staff is good, are really, really good at their job. They care about what they're doing. You don't get a nonprofit to be wealthy.
Gotcha.
You get, because you want to do something. It's your job, your calling. You're not doing it to try and, to retire at age 40.
Yeah.
You're doing it because you this is what you want to do. And we have very, very good people, and they care about other people also, and families with autism.
Perfect. Thanks, BJ.
Thank you so much.
As you've heard this evening through the stories that both Oren and BJ Surhoff have spoken about, making your way through life is all about preparing yourself, being in touch with your own inner strength, and then having a plan and working hard to make that plan happen. I'm not just talking about finding success as a life coach or a Major League Baseball player. Just look around. You'll see plenty of people who contend every day with life struggles and how they keep trying to make better lives for themselves. My sister was one such person. She was always my protector. It started out when we were just two small kids living in a shack in Rainbow, California, a remote community in northern San Diego County. I was 16 months and my sister was 5 when she took on the role of being my mother too. At that time, we were living with just my father, a single, dysfunctional dad. He sometimes worked in construction when work was available. During those times, he was gone much of the day, and when he wasn't working, he was involved in a variety of activities that led to him not being home. There was also an occasion where our dad was locked up in jail. The result was that my sister looked after me. She often made sure that I had food to eat. We'd go down a pathway to this little church where we'd get food. That's where Pastor Ed was. Remarkably, I discovered where Pastor Ed is today, and he was our special guest on our first Life's Tough broadcast. Back to the early days with my sister. When both of us landed in California's foster care system and went from home to home, my sister always tried to protect me in those situations too, when she could. Fast forward about 20 years. My sister is married with 2 young kids, and she's in a troubled marriage. They're living in a townhouse in Baltimore. Prior to her marriage, she had been in a variety of drug rehab clinics trying to stay clean. The person she married is trying to contend with his own demons. Yet even with all the dysfunction thrown at her during childhood, she still aims to make a better life, a normal life. She is resilient and she is tough. She goes to school to become a dental hygienist. She works a late night shift at 24-hour diner in Baltimore City. and she's taking care of the kids during the day. All it takes is all you got. She gave all she had. She does become a dental hygienist, but her marriage is increasingly shaky, and she's becoming ever more desperate to pull enough money together to pay for the rent. Ultimately, things did not turn out well in my sister Tennille's case. She eventually moved to Yakima in Washington State with her husband and kids. Members of her husband's family offered to help with watching the kids. Both she and her husband needed to get their lives straightened out. My sister really did want to go off to the far end of the world. Yet she didn't want to go, but they did. And she and her husband were soon captives of their recurring drug addictions. In October 2011, her husband's battle with depression and addiction ended when he committed suicide. He was 29 years old. Then in August 2014, my sister died of an overdose. She was 33. On top of all that, it still pains me to think that there are programs out there that could help people like Tennille. One such program is a program based in Cabo San Lucas, a place where they know and they understand people like Tennille. People like Dustin, people that struggle with a life of worry and a life of pain and a life of addictions. Addictions come in many forms. They come with the cell phone, they come with the iPad, they come with the pain of a trial, a tribulation, trauma that they carry with them through their lives. I would like to thank our sponsor, POI Institute, located in gorgeous Cabo San Lucas in Mexico on the Baja California Peninsula. This is one such place that Tennille never got to go to. It's a new facility of luxury, a holistic detox center that offers safe, medically focused Ibogaine detox treatments for individuals suffering from a variety of addictions. Call the POI Institute at 833-POI-CABO and tell them Life's Tough sent you. As we talked earlier to BJ Surhoff, what we've seen is that life's tough. You can be a Major League Baseball player. You can be a janitor. And that along your journey and along the way, something will come up, something you did not expect. And if you look around you, there are people there to support you. There is a community. There is a village. On the first episode, I said you need to find a Pastor Ed in your life, someone that will be there for you. Now I encourage you, find a BJ Surhoff. Find a Pathfinders for Autism. Find a Polly. Find someone that you can lean on. In the early days, you're struggling with not knowing how to deal with a child that might have a problem, that might be a little different. Well, BJ Surhoff and his family, they decided to do something about it. And so I'd ask you that if you have a family, a friend, or a neighbor, please go to Pathfinders for Autism. They are there to support you. They understand what it's like to deal with the unknown. They are your biggest fan. They are your family. In closing, I would like to thank the audience once again for listening in and tuning in all around the world to hear the message that is so simple, yet is many ways, like the first time we hear it, so powerful. Life's tough. You can be tougher. You heard earlier from Dr. Steve Planholt. Dr. Steve Planholt years ago gave me some advice. I was complaining about not having time. He said, Dustin, you will always find at least 1 minute to do the things you want to do. I'd encourage you this week that 1 minute you have each and every day to use it. Use it to gain knowledge and power. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Next week on April 17th, we'll welcome actor Bobby Burke to Life's Tough. You may know Bobby from his appearance on Law & Order and on the HBO miniseries Generation Kill. He's quite an interesting guy. That's Bobby Burke on April 17th. This is Dustin Planholt, signing off for Life's Tough. You can be tougher.